Libro.fm lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. Choose from more than 150,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know what one we're talking about, but you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community.
If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. Listen while doing chores, walking the dog, or just relaxing at home. All you need is a smartphone and the free Libro.fm app.
If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to next, check out recommendations and curated lists from the people who know audiobooks best, local booksellers.
Listeners of the Bookstore Podcast can get a 2-month audiobook membership for the price of 1 month.
Go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter bookstore at checkout. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores.
Welcome to the bookstore.
It's like a book club, but we actually read the book.
I'm Becca.
And I am Corinne. We don't have much official news this week, but I'm going to take this opportunity to address our American listeners really quickly. You may have heard that there is an election coming up, but I figured I'd ask you in person very kindly to please vote this year. I am probably preaching to the choir right now, but maybe you also know friends or family who just don't know where to get started to figure out how to vote or to figure out if they're registered. The National Association of Secretaries of State website can point you, no matter what state you live in, to the right place to find all sorts of voting information for your state. I have a link in the show notes, but the webpage you're looking for will be nass.org/can-i-vote. You can check your registration status and information related to where you vote and options for absentee, like if your state is just sending out absentee ballots to everybody, because some states are doing that. If you need to apply for an absentee ballot, if you want to do that. And all sorts of different information related to voting absentee, because this is kind of a crazy year. So you should find out now when your state needs your absentee ballot to be returned. This stuff varies state by state, and in some places, election day is too late to turn in your absentee ballot. In some places, you can turn in your absentee ballot at your polling location, but in some places you cannot. So know what that is for your state. Know when the deadline is. Find out where drop-off locations are located. If you're going to put it in the mail, find out when you need to do that to make sure it's going to get there safely. But if you can, I do suggest dropping it off at a drop-off location. You can also see what's going to be on your ballot. I think most places, it's like within 60 days of the election, they need to have a sample ballot listed online for you to check out. I think they also tend to print them in newspapers if you get those anymore. The presidential election is not the most important thing on your ballot. It's not also not the only thing on your ballot. So encourage your friends and family to look at sample ballots and maybe even fill out a provisional ballot. If you're voting in person, you can take that with you as a cheat sheet. And finally, if you're voting absentee this year, read the instructions very carefully. When voting in person, you can screw up 1,000 times and they have to keep getting you a new ballot. But with absentee, if you forget to sign the back of your envelope, you're shit out of luck. So do be conscious of the instructions. Follow them carefully. Sign it where it says you need to sign it. Make sure you're filling out the bubbles or whatever it happens to be in the way that they are instructing you to on the ballot. One actual final thing. I know I said finally, but this will be the final thing. If you're not in an at-risk group, I also want to encourage you to volunteer to work at your local polling place. So this is based on just personal observations, but I'd say the average age of a poll worker in my area is about 120 years old. So if you are generally healthy and don't have many risk factors, it would be great help for you to volunteer to work the polls this year. Keep people who are at risk home, safe from COVID. At least in Michigan, PPE and hand sanitizers are provided at your polling locations. You also get paid for the day and for your training. You can usually find an application simply by Googling the name of your city or state and election worker application. I hope you consider it. I had fun working the primary. I'm looking forward to the general election. It's nice to get out and help your community and see people in your community, especially in this crazy year where I kind of forgot that I'm not the only person alive. That's all for my soapbox for today. Now we can get on to discussing our book.
Cool. Okay. Okay, so Luster by Raven Leilani was published on August 4th of this year. So this is like very hot off the presses for us. It was published by FSG. Disclaimer here, I did receive my copy by winning a Goodreads giveaway. So thank you to FSG for sponsoring that. Corinne bought her book, though. So, yeah.
I did.
So Luster follows a 23-year-old woman named Edie who works at an unfulfilling job in publishing and begins a relationship with an older married man. That relationship or affair does not proceed like the average extramarital affair as Edie gets entangled with Eric's wife and daughter. Here is a quote from the publisher about the book. Edie is stumbling through her 20s, sharing a subpar apartment in Bushwick, clocking in and out of her admin job, making a series of inappropriate sexual choices. She's also secretly, haltingly figuring her way into life as an artist. And then she meets Eric, a digital archivist with a family in New Jersey, including an autopsist wife who has agreed to an open marriage with rules. As if navigating the constantly shifting landscapes of contemporary sexual manners and racial politics weren't hard enough, Edie finds herself unemployed and falling into Eric's family life, his home. She becomes a hesitant friend to his wife and a de facto role model to his adopted daughter. Edie is the only Black woman young Akilah may know. That's what it's about.
Yes. Yep.
I guess I will open up to say this is, to me, has some strong similarities to two previous novels we've read on the podcast, both by Otessa Moshfegh, My Year of Rest and Relaxation, and Eileen. Would you agree or disagree?
Yeah, I was gonna bring those up as well. Is it a spoiler? Well, okay, hold on. I think we'll probably be spoiling some things. As usual, we'll try to let you know before we do anything major. My spoiler is probably going to be that I really, really liked this book. And I was thinking about also how it was pretty similar to Moshfegh's writing. And also a couple of other things that I was thinking about, like a lot like Fleabag, kind of, the television series mm-hmm. by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and a little bit like Girls is what I was thinking about, too. I think it really kind of does capture, like, a millennial type of mood, and I'm just always sort of excited to see that in, like, you know, real hardbound, big publisher type of context. So
yes, I will add one more is Sally Rooney's work, especially Normal People, which I liked a lot. I did not really like her first novel, Conversations with Friends, but a lot of similarities. And I think that's more of just maybe, I guess like how old the writers are who are writing these things. I don't mm-hmm. really want to call it a trend or anything else. I just think that's the way literature is kind of going with women who are probably around our age, I think.
No, yeah. I mean, I think this is definitely pretty generational. I don't know how old Otessa Moshfegh is, 39, which puts her at like the very tail end of Gen X, early millennial. Mm-hmm. And then I think Raven Leilani is probably just about my age, 29,
and
last year.
And so is Sally Rooney is also 29. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But, and I will also, I guess, here's my spoiler. I also really like this. This is a debut. I feel like I generally need to, like, manage my expectations when it comes to debuts that get a lot of praise. But I think this one, I'm always like if somebody calls a debut, like, electrifying and intense and incredible, mm-hmm. I'm always like, okay, I'm probably going to read it and think this is fine.
Yeah.
But this one, I think, was really, really good. It's like shockingly good for a debut novel, like so good.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I can relate to like a lot of the feelings. We talked about with My Year of Rest and Relaxation, this kind of like incredible apathy, burgeoning on like who cares if I die sort mm-hmm. of feeling that I think has it's become a joke. It's a little bit of a meme, but it's like, it's very prevalent among our generation and among, I think, Gen X too, to the point where it's like this almost like dark sort of suicide joke, which isn't funny, but it does capture like a feeling, I think, generationally. And it's very uncomfortable. I don't know better words to put it in than that. So apologies. Yeah, I think it's got that, where I think this like rises above some of the other things that I mentioned, including like the TV shows I mentioned, is of course that it's those things tend to be incredibly white and also from places of like immense like class privilege and stuff. When Edie is struggling financially and in other ways socially, she has nowhere to fall back on necessarily. And so that's much more prescient in the writing, I think.
Well, agree 100%. And I think this is something that both Leilani and Moshfegh explore, is young women being lonely and loneliness. Mm-hmm. And I think that's not always something that's explored in this way. You know, even though in this book, Leilani explores how Edie is like wanting a relationship with Eric, her loneliness isn't really about not having a man or not having a partner. It's about more than that, because she doesn't have any parents. And with the money thing that you brought up, I think that it made me so nervous and anxious for her, because I'm already a nervous person about money. But yeah, it just added something so much more real with what, you know, the like Moshfegh's character in Rest and Relaxation. Like, it was fun to read about somebody who doesn't have to care about money. But in reality, that's not, like, among other things in that book, it's not reality for the vast majority of people.
Yeah. And you know, God, I don't want this book to all be about someone else's writing comparatively. But yeah, in that one, the problems that she has, which like while some of them are emotional and related to the trauma of, you know, like absent parents and your parents being dead, like a lot of the problems she creates for herself. And while, you know, some of that is true for, I suppose, every person, she had money to fall back on. She was able to take that year off of work and live in her New York apartment and just completely zonk out. And that's not really an option for Edie in this novel. So yeah, all of those things are much more real and much more dangerous, I think. But at the same time, the book still manages to be funny. Kind of, you know, darkly, I suppose, but there's still humor in it. And I really liked it a lot.
Yeah,
it seemed more realistic. And there were stakes. And yeah, wow, I didn't expect to like it, because I didn't know what it was going to be going in. And there's always like a little bit when there's like a woman who's like, when a book or media is about a woman who has like a lot of sex or something like that, I'm like, oh, is this going to be like a cool girl thing? And then I was just very happy and surprised to see that it like pulled through, and she was more fully fleshed than, you know, just those things. It wasn't just like a cool girl book.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think in that vein, like when a book contains a lot of sex, I have a feeling that sort of the media around it just sort of attaches to that one perspective, like one part of the book. And that's yes, of course there is sex in this book, but not as much as you would think if you just read.
Not as much as The Old Drift.
Yeah. 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 True. I also think this book really dealt with shame in a way that's very different. Like, shame over not having money. Like, I don't know. So I guess we should say this is a little bit of a minor spoiler. Edie loses her job and she ends up moving in. I don't know if I already said this in the summary. She ends up moving in with Eric and his wife, Rebecca, and their adopted daughter, Akila. And so that whole dynamic, I mean, there's so many things to explore, but specifically the sort of shame of not having anywhere to go, knowing you kind of put yourself in this position and now you are forced to rely on people, but it's so humiliating, but yet you still have to do it. I don't know. It's there's a lot going on there.
It's also like, I think another reason why I'm surprised that I enjoyed it is like the setup for it is like so seemingly unnatural, where, you know, she makes this terrible decision to basically go break into Eric's house when she thinks no one is there and just like walk around and look at his things and touch his stuff and see what his wife is like. And turns out that his wife is home, and then she chases her out of the house. And then the wife, Becca, invites Edie to stay for this party, and it turns out to be their anniversary party. And Edie, or Rebecca, does know that her husband is having a relationship with Edie. It's a part of a, as Dan Savage would call it, like monogamish situation. So it's on one hand like the most viscerally embarrassing thing I can imagine, and also something that I can't imagine happening in real life. But somehow she manages to pull it off in a way that I was just like, okay, like I can see this just being a person making the worst decisions, and then, mm-hmm. you know, these worst decisions kind of ballooning out in a way that you can think of it as an interesting like thought experiment of like what would it be if these people had to live their lives together. And it worked for me, surprisingly.
Yeah, completely. For me, it was, I think the way the story is told is really clever too, because in the beginning, a lot of Edie's choices, I was like, nobody would actually act like this. Like, nobody is like this bizarre to get fired and then return to their workplace and go try to talk to somebody they had an affair with once. Like, but as the story goes, you find out more about Edie's past, and it all makes more sense.
Yeah.
In why she is the way she is and why she is so self-destructive.
I liked the way that, well, first of all, I guess I should also say that I it's not just like the story itself that I liked, but I thought the writing was really, I hate it when people say this, but I've already had a little bit of whiskey, so my words aren't great now. But it flowed really well, in that she manages to be incredibly descriptive, give you enough of what she's thinking and feeling without it just being like all consuming, complete navel gazing. And the way that she would be describing an action or something that was happening with her, and then she would kind of go back into this memory about her life with either her mother or her father, and then a little bit of their history, felt really natural and nice. And it gave enough of that context that when you went back into the scene, it really did matter, like that you knew that information, you know, mm-hmm. In a way that wasn't superfluous or anything. I mean, this book is short. It's like 225 pages long. And it felt quick, and it still feels really full and really dense at the same time. Like, everything in there was useful information, which I think is like such a feat now, just because of the way that like the first person perspective tends to be very meandering and circular mm-hmm. within like people's thoughts.
Yeah, it's also in present tense, which I don't like present tense.
I didn't even notice. Oh, my God.
Yeah. But I didn't notice until a little bit of the ways in. And then I was like shocked, because that's how good she writes, is she was able to. I didn't even notice. Like, normally it's very, very distracting to me for present tense. But this like it was just really good. I do want to make a note of sort of the style too, like what you were saying with the descriptiveness, because I think if somebody told me they did not like the writing, I could kind of understand, because here is almost, let's see, this is on page 5.
Okay.
So she says, I put on a complex pair of underwear that is not so much underwear as a bundle of string, and I stand before the mirror. I think to myself, you are a desirable woman. You are not a dozen gerbils in a skin casing. So that does ring very creative writing, kind yeah. of writing. Now, I liked that. I thought it worked perfectly for who Edie is and how she would think.
I laughed at that. The gerbils in skin casing, yeah. I thought was very funny. And it also matches the tone of someone that age. Like, that is a TikTok joke. So it yes. works really well. Yeah.
Yeah, and it does, I think it veers a little bit close to the sort of cool girl type writing too for me. But like I said, so at first when I read that, I was like, oh, okay, this is the kind of book that it's going to be. But pleasantly surprised, writing was great, and it worked.
Like I already mentioned the thing about her being invited, basically. Well, not even invited so much as kind of like coerced to stay at this anniversary party, which honestly, I mean, like the whole situation is a nightmare that I would say I've had. But there's this description of her being at the party. I'm gonna read this paragraph that I actually remembered the page number that it was on, because I was like, okay, I guess I'm here for this because I find this incredibly relatable. She's at the party. She's the only Black woman there. And she is, you know, incredibly uncomfortable because she's also been, you know, seeing the man that the anniversary party is for. And so she says, it is a foregone conclusion that I will once or twice hurt someone's feelings deeply because of something I say or a face I make, which I will, of course, think about when I ride the train home, and actually forever. Even though I tried to be merry and keep the conversation light, even though I can't sleep and I can't shit and someone is dying, but that one song tells you to slide to the left and you have no choice. I am incredibly uncomfortable at parties, and I think, like, in a weird way, like the insane situation that she finds herself in at this party, like it just felt like the right kind of hyperbole for my relationship to being like nervous at a party of like a friend that isn't a close friend, and there's a lot of people you don't know there. And also that idea of like saying the wrong thing and thinking about it on the train ride home, but actually forever. Like, you know, you wake up in the middle of the night and you remember the stupid thing you said to somebody 10 years ago. Like, that is, I think, our condition as a generation. And so it felt really real to me. And that was the point where I was like, you know what, I'm just going to go along with this. And then I really, really loved it. So,
yeah, I mean, I would go so far as to say I get nervous if I like talked too much. Not even like that I talked over somebody, just that like I talked a little bit too much and I have to ask Zach, like, did I talk too much? Was that okay?
I go home from every party, even with very close friends, and I think, oh my God, my friends hate me. That's the wrong takeaway to have. It is, because they don't, but I do think it every single time. So we could probably move on to more specific questions if you'd like.
I just want a couple side notes. One side note is, do you think she chose the name Rebecca because Becky is a slang for white women?
I did think about that. I don't know for sure. Just because, like, I don't think that Rebecca fits that stereotype necessarily. I actually find Rebecca to be the most confusing character in the entire book. She is
same,
but I you know, like, I think I wish that I knew like a little bit more about her and why she made the choices she did, but I suppose if you were Edie, you wouldn't necessarily know either. You would have this kind of like remove from the wife of your boyfriend, essentially. But I did sometimes find her a little bit frustrating, just because like you find out that, I don't know, she's just so strange. I assume she sings Phil Collins' In the Air Tonight at the anniversary party, like a cappella. And then she's also like a mortician, and she's also like goes to metal shows and goes into the mosh pits topless. And so, yeah, I found her to be a bit of an enigma.
Yeah, I did too. And there were times where I was like, what? I would almost like a chapter to see inside Rebecca's head. But I think you're also completely right, as I think that was part of her whole thing, is she was so, Edie just couldn't figure her out. Like, why was she doing anything that she was doing? And that is sort of an interesting, also a very interesting position to be in, where we are looking through Edie's perspective and wondering, what is happening? How am I supposed to navigate this relationship? Very awkward and uncomfortable, for sure. My other side note was, I know Edie's dad was considerably older than her mom. And I understand this is not important. And this is one of the things that really gets me in books when I feel like I need to know this very specific answer to this thing that is really kind of meaningless in the broad scheme of the book. But how old was he? Edie refers to like him being in the war, and she mentions that her dad calls Germans Krauts, which is, he's not a World War II veteran.
No, I assumed he was a Vietnam vet.
Okay.
I also found, okay, this is my one bone to pick with the book, which is that the whole time I was kind of wondering, is Edie my age? But then I would hear that she's 20 something. And then at the very end, basically, she says she's 23. And I find that confusing because of like some of the references she's made seem like they would be much more targeted at someone like exactly my age, around 30. Mm-hmm. So like, some of those things I thought didn't quite work, except now I'm Googling that Deb's Shops, because at one point she says that she works at a mall that basically just has like a Deb shop, which...
Okay, that also was confusing because Deb was big when I was high school, yeah. Young high school.
Yeah,
for
I was
sure.
In middle school. I think Deb was like fair, like still kind of cool, but I Googled it now and Deb went out of business, I think, in 2015.
Oh, wow. That lasted a long time.
Retail locations. So I guess maybe I'm wrong because I was like, what? How old is she and what year is it? And then there's a point where she says something about 2018. I think that's when her dad died. Anyway, so I think her dad probably was a Vietnam vet. I don't know why he would have called Germans Krauts, because that doesn't make a lot of sense to me unless he spent a lot of time with people who fought in the war, which maybe he did, because my dad was born in 1949. And I, like, for me, like, I am 30 years old, and I knew people who had grandparents who were as old as my parents. So that was always kind of a thing. I've got old parents. So I think probably her dad would have been roughly my parents' age. So when she was born, I would say he probably would have been almost 50, because my parents were 40 when I was born.
Okay. Because that makes sense.
I said I'm 30. I'm also 31. I don't know what year it is. It's okay.
After you turn 30, it doesn't really matter anymore, is what I've come to the conclusion. But yeah, so that makes sense, because my dad is too young to have gone to Vietnam, because he was born in 59.
My dad attempted to enlist, but he couldn't because he had asthma. So, I think that was that was like a whole thing. So that's basically my reference point with that. So yeah, he would have been very old but pretty old for a father.
Anyway, that was, again, it's those, and you're right. There was a few of her references with some, she brings up some news items, and I understand that she like tweaks them a little bit to not necessarily completely reference the real life thing that happened. But it is weird when it's like, okay, so that happened last year. And I wish I could think of an exact example, but I can't. And I didn't write down the page number. But it's like, okay, that happened within the last few years. So it must be now that this is taking place, or like 2018 or 19 or whatever.
Yeah, it must have been around then. Because I was also wondering, like, because it sort of seems like Akila, maybe she says something about being in... You know, she's from Louisiana, the daughter, and she's 13. These are all like insane details that I don't know why I'm bothering dissecting, because in the grand scheme of the book, it's very good. But in my brain, yes. I'm like, but when was Hurricane Katrina? There's no way that Akila could be 13 years old, because like there's stuff about FEMA and like her mother dying in Katrina. And she would have been exactly like born the year that Katrina happened, and I don't think that would have been possible for her to remember anything. So yeah. Not that any of that matters, because it's not real life. It could have been a different flood, it could have been a different hurricane, it could have been anything, but for some reason my brain attaches to it and I can't let it go.
Yeah, I do the exact same thing. I guess I'm always trying to like center when exactly a story is happening, if it's around this time, what everybody's ages are, you know, what was going on when they were young. I don't know why I do it, but yeah. one thing, and I don't know, I'm going to read a passage that's like towards the mm-hmm. end, so I don't know if it's a spoiler or not, but it's not really revealing any information. But so Eric is like significantly older than Edie. I think he's in his 50s.
Late 40s, I think, probably. But yeah.
Late 40s. Okay. And I thought that was really, it was a really interesting exploration of why young women go after old, or like are interested in older men. It's something that I can't relate to. I've never felt that. And also older men have never liked me. So the feeling is mutual. But towards the end, there's something that I thought she writes that's really, really interesting. Okay, so she's talking, thinking about Eric, and she says, "He is the most obvious thing that has ever happened to me, and all around the city it is happening to other silly, half-formed women excited by men who've simply met the prerequisite of living a little more life, a terribly unspecial thing that is just what happens when you keep on getting up and brushing your teeth and going to work and ignoring the whisper that comes to you at night and tells you it would be easier to be dead. So sure, an older man is a wonder because he has paid 38 years of Con Ed bills and suffered food poisoning and seen the climate reports and still not killed himself, but somehow, after being a woman for 23 years, after the ovarian torsion and student loans and newfangled Nazis and button downs, I too am still alive, and actually this is the more remarkable feat. Instead, I let myself be awed by his middling command of the wine list." And I think that's kind of interesting because it kind of shows how, you know, Edie wants Eric for what reason? Like, she's just attracted to the fact that he's essentially older and knows things that she doesn't know. But at the same time, she knows plenty of things that he doesn't know. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, they bring her into their home, basically, because of the fact that she's the only person they know who can help their daughter, basically. So, yeah, I mean, her mm-hmm. experience is, like, obviously incredibly valuable. But, yeah, I think that selection of text really stuck out to me, too. I think, you know, it is... It does just kind of really highlight the sort of privilege that, you know, a certain kind of strata of white man has. I mean, it is the kind of meme of like the mediocre white man, you know, like, mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, there is a comfort in that, right? Like that somebody can carry themselves so confidently through life that way. It is sort of like remarkable when you've had a completely different experience.
And I think the book does it more slowly too, you know, as Edie sees him more and more in sort of embarrassing situations mm-hmm. or times when like his fly is down and it's sort of, he's not so much of a, I don't know, fascinating figure right. anymore. Like he's just a person. He doesn't really know what he's doing. He's not really all that smart either, mm-hmm. I guess. So do you want to talk a little bit about Edie's relationship with Akilah?
Yeah. I found it, oh God, it's so awkward because kids are, I don't know, I find it difficult even as someone who I would say 85% sure that I would like to have children. And I also find relating to kids really, really hard. and so I felt like mm-hmm. I felt a lot of that here. And that's, you know, also without like the added complication of basically like this woman's existence in this home being so that she could, I don't know, like figure out what to do with Akilah's hair, you know, basically. And so I kind of really liked their relationship, like how sort of push and pull it was, like their interest in each other, but also like knowing the generational difference, I think a little bit. And also just like the fact that it's really complicated that both of them were kind of forced on one another because of their situation of being like the only black people that these white people know. I guess I always find like relationships that come out of like weird circumstances kind of endearing.
I did too. And I also thought it was really interesting how in a lot of ways Akilah's past trauma sort of made her more mature. Mm-hmm. Like she knew Edie was her dad's girlfriend.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And she knows kind of, you know, what is going on. Like, she tells Edie, like, this is a good place. Don't mess this up. While Edie, because of what went on in her past, she is kind of more immature in some ways. So I know they're like, I mean, they're only 10 years apart, so that's pretty close in age anyway. But it did make them feel even more closer in age because of that. And then also with Akila, I did like how in anytime you get somebody who's like around 13, it's like they're mature in some ways, but then also like very immature. And like the way, I think the way Akila was written and how, you know, embarrassed she got of things and how much she wanted like to cosplay, but then it didn't turn out right. And she was like, didn't want to say anything, but she was really disappointed. I don't know. That whole, I think, again, yes, the whole, their dynamic and just Akila as a character was very, very interesting.
Agreed. I also loved just the fact that, like, it showed, I think, what people don't think of as, like, necessarily, like, stereotypical, like, black interest. You know, that Akila was, like, very into video games and cosplay and fan fiction and all of those things, which, of course, black people are also interested in, but doesn't necessarily get representation in media and that sort of thing. I really liked that. And then also just like the whole scene where they go to Comic-Con, which is like, honest to God, my nightmare. I cannot imagine being around that many people who are like really excited to be there. I don't like big crowds. So like that whole thing like really amped up like sort of just the weird tensions between everybody at the time for me. So yeah. I just thought that was an interesting kind of like thing to wrench into the center there of like these adults having to go and like participate in fandoms in order to support a child, and just making it like, you know, extra weird a little bit.
To go back, if you don't Absolutely. Mind, to Edie and Rebecca, I think that whole thing is also interesting because it kind of changes what we think about how the mistress and the wife would think about each other and relate to each other. Because there's really not any jealousy on Rebecca's part.
Yeah.
There is a point when she like gets tired of Edie living in her house, but we don't really know whether it's because Edie is still having a sexual affair with her husband or if it's just because she's tired of having an unemployed person living in her house that she's paying for. Like, we don't really know that. And I don't know if I have a question about that. I just think it's interesting. And then it also, I did kind of think that at some point I would feel sorry for Rebecca or feel pity for her, because Edie does compare herself to Rebecca and thinks that she's prettier and she has a better body and things like that. And I'm like, maybe I'm just kind of sensitive to that. But in the end, I didn't ever feel bad for Rebecca because honestly, Eric is not a prize.
I think I think that's the takeaway. I mostly feel bad for both of the women. And I think,
yeah,
you know, like there's shows like Sister Wives and stuff that I always think about. And I'm like, I can't imagine. Right. And then I think the real takeaway is just like, oh, I feel bad for women in general. Like yeah. There's why necessarily would you need to feel jealous over that? Yeah, I think that came across like really clearly. I found their relationship really interesting. I can't imagine trying to forge a friendship that way, right? Like, or not even a friendship, just a basic relationship that way. And it came off, I guess, more or less realistically, like where you're keeping a distance, but also you're interested in one another, but also, you know, like the whole thing's just too weird. And especially like with the racial differences and that sort of thing, like that there are just like too many experiences that you don't necessarily understand about one another that also creates more distance. So I found that very fascinating.
Yeah. And I mean, I think Rebecca is not a great mom. You know, she obviously does a lot of things that I would disagree with and think that you should never do to your child, like counting the kids' calories. Yeah. But I think she also is able to recognize that Edie is good for Akila, and Akila needs somebody like Edie in her life. Well, do you want to talk about the ending?
Sure.
The two big things that happen in the end.
Yeah. So spoilers. I don't know. I would say skip ahead a few minutes if you're not interested in being spoiled on this. But yeah, so the last, I would say 20 pages or something really packs like a lot of action in. I think probably I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people didn't really like the way that transpired. I would say I was like a little bit surprised by how quickly they kind of rolled out. But at the same time, I didn't totally sort of hate it. I was definitely waiting for a moment where like some big sort of action thing would occur.
Yeah.
And so then you finally get it.
Yeah. I think that the specific thing with the police coming, that one I did expect to happen. I think it was maybe resolved, not resolved, but there wasn't much discussion of how they were affected by it afterward.
Mm-hmm.
I think that could have been a little bit longer, but I didn't, that happening, you know, I figured it was going to come up at some point. The other thing that I didn't really think was as great is Edie gets pregnant and she ends up having a miscarriage. And I kind of just feel like whenever a character has an unintended pregnancy and they don't know whether to get an abortion or what they're going to do, if they're going to keep the baby, which I think Edie was leaning towards keeping it, when the character has a miscarriage, it kind of feels like a cop out.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that for sure. I kind of thought of it because it happens the same night as the trauma of being thrown on the ground by police. So I kind of thought of it, at least in this case, I saw it as like an extension of that same violence, if that makes sense. I guess I didn't necessarily think of it as much of a like an excuse to not have to have her make a decision, although I can definitely see that feeling as well.
No, that's true though. And I didn't really think about that because I guess I kind of thought she was so early in her pregnancy that I didn't really connect the two. Because I know obviously she was a victim of police violence, but I guess I didn't connect it with maybe that also caused the miscarriage. And thinking about it that way does make a whole lot more sense.
Yeah. I don't know a ton about pregnancy either. So I don't know if that's necessarily something that could have, you know, caused that to happen, but I guess I was thinking about it as in an extension of all of that. But
no, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so I guess end spoiler.
Sure, yes.
So I guess I have only one more thing that I really want to talk about, but in Parul Sehgal's New York Times review, she says novels by young writers tend to attract a strange sort of attention, more anthropological than literary. What does the work of Sally Rooney tell us about millennial precarity? What does Kristen Rupenian's Cat Person reveal about gender and power? It's not that fiction can't be a rich mine of evidence, but such analyses often go against how and why most people read. Do we go to Anne Petrie for a sociological snapshot of mid-century Harlem life, Anna Karenina for hot takes on the sexual politics of the Russian landed gentry? We don't go to novels because they are timely, but because they feel timeless in their treatment of consciousness and emotional life. We don't want characters to exist as a bundle of symptoms, but as full personalities in their rich confusion and ambivalence. And I guess I kind of agree with that, and I kind of disagree with that, but what do you think?
I feel like I'm probably in the same boat as you, more or less. I don't know that we can necessarily say that, like, I don't think that we can necessarily say that it's timeless in their treatment of consciousness and emotional life, while also not being a bundle of symptoms and full personalities in their rich confusion and ambivalence or whatever it is that she says at the end there. I think both things can be true at the same time. I think this can be an example or a snapshot, or at least, you know, like a temperature gauge for how our culture is right now, at least for a very specific kind of point of view, right? Like,
yeah,
I don't necessarily think that like an author can write an entire generation, but also I don't think that they can write all of the human experience. So I think we've got both things going
yeah.
on.
Yeah, I think that, you know, and Leilani even writes it, as Edie says, something like, why does it have to be my generation? Why can't it just be me specifically? Right. And I think that's absolutely true. I think, you know, as much as we did like kind of compare similarities, I think Leilani's writing is ultimately very unique and the content very much mm-hmm. hers. But I also think that like, I think differently than somebody in 19th century Russia.
Yeah.
The way I think is informed by what is around me. And so to kind of say that this some book, you know, forever ago is timeless, I just don't think it's right. I don't think any book is timeless. I think that every single one, you know, really where you are and when it was written.
Yeah. And I think there's certain things about like characters that speak more largely to the human condition, but they are shaped by the society and the culture that you are brought up in. And, you know, while those things change over time, I think you can absolutely relate to Anna Karenina just as much as you can relate to mm-hmm. Luster. I don't think either one of them has to be the correct answer. And maybe, I guess that's more or less where I fall on everything, right? Like, nothing has to be black and white that way. So, yeah.
Same. And I mean, I think it's always kind of a little bit like, I don't know, kind of silly, because we don't know if Luster is going to be a classic and going to be read 100 years from now. I think this is a debut novel and it's so good that who knows how great her next novel is going to be. But we just don't know how to say, like, we know what are classics from back in the day, but we don't know what wasn't a classic right. and what didn't make it. So how can we really say, you know, well, this novel is too present or too millennial to continue? And I don't think that's what Parul Sehgal was saying in her review. I'm just editorializing.
I do definitely look forward to Leilani's future novels. I think she did a really fantastic job here. I just kind of can't wait to see what she does next.
Yeah, this was really, really good. I feel like probably a lot of people have already been considering buying it or bought it already or read it already. Yes, you should. We endorse.
Well, thanks for listening to The Bookstore.
If you would like to support the podcast beyond listening, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thebookstore or rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.
Definitely reach out to us if you have read Luster and let us know what you think. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it because we really enjoyed it. And I know I've heard from a few of you that you plan on reading it or have read it. Thank you to Alex, who is the comptroller of Booktown, for suggesting this on our Patreon, because this was a Patreon choice. So you can find all the ways that you can contact us and let us know your thoughts on it. Email, our social media, and our phone line are all at thebookstorepodcast.com.
What's our next book? Is it Tyra Banks?
We can't go more opposite with this one.
Our next book discussion, we're doing a real 180 here, and we're going to read Model Land by Tyra Banks. Iconic talk show, America's Next Top Model host.
Supermodel.
Supermodel, yes, of course. We wanted to do something a little bit more light.
It's been a while since we've read something just to read it for it being bonkers. So
you can find it at your local library. Not sure about bookstore. I don't know. I don't think it's in print anymore. So hopefully your library.
You might just not even want to read it and just listen to us discuss it, because it is about 600 pages long. So The Bookstore is a production of Awkwardly Social Media, produced by Becca Young and Corinne Keener. Technical and production support is provided by Josh Bourdon and Zach Titus.
And John, if you're out there, thanks for listening.
See you next Tuesday.
Bye. older men have never liked me, so the feeling is mutual.